Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Hayes Wuhib coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The announcement from the EU is that they are developing a process now. They will begin making sure that there will be no automatic return. They say everyone will be given the right to apply for asylum. They will consider each case individually.
That's VOA correspondent Luis Ramirez in Izmir, Turkey. He says the EU is making changes in how it deports migrants to Turkey. Details coming up.
Also, the UN-backed unity government in Libya is moving to take control of the country's finances and institutions after the rival Tripoli-based government gave up power. And military officials in Nigeria and Cameroon say a joint offensive in recent days has led to the capture of more than 300 Boko Haram militants.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Arab media reports that Libya's unrecognized government in Tripoli has formally stepped down in favor of the new unity government of Prime Minister-designate Fayez al-Sarraj. The internationally recognized parliament in Tobruk also failed today to reach a quorum to vote to approve Mr. Sarraj's cabinet. Edward Uranian reports from Cairo.
أكد مقرر مجلس النواب صالح قلمة تأجيل جلسة الثلاثاء لعدم اكتمال النصاب القانوني.
Libyan TV reports the country's internationally recognized parliament, the House of Representatives based in Tobruk, once again postponed its approval of the country's UN-mediated national unity government, despite moves by the rival government and parliament in Tripoli to cede power to it. The television channel announced the new government's Council of State met in Tripoli and elected Abdulrahman Sawahli to be its head. It also reported Libya's central bank has been instructed to stop paying institutions that do not take orders from the new administration. A key member of the parliament in Tobruk, Abu Bakr Baira, told Arab media the new Council of State has not been legally approved and warned Prime Minister-designate Fayez al-Sarraj's new unity government must be approved by parliament in order to be lawful. Al Arabiya TV reported the Tobruk parliament was unable to obtain a quorum to vote on Sarraj's cabinet. It said it was the ninth bid to hold a session to approve the new government. Parliament Speaker Aguila Sala has told Arab media that his body agrees to the new government, but not to all the ministers that have been proposed to be a part of it. The unrecognized government in Tripoli and the General National Congress, a rival Tripoli-based parliament, officially ceded power to the new government this week. But a faction in the Tripoli parliament opposed the move. SADC Institute Director Anas El-Ghomati tells VOA there are major power centers in Libya that do not accept the unity government. He says the head of the parliament in Tobruk insists Army Commander Khalifa Haftar be part of the government.
Khalifa Haftar is unwilling to cede his position as the chief of the army in the HOR government. And any new government of national accord will end up seeing him resign his post. Now that is what the HOR is holding this government of national accord at ransom to. They want the Libyan political agreement changed and adapt so that they can keep Khalifa Haftar in his current position and continue the status quo in the east.
UN Libya envoy Martin Kobler stated in a tweet Wednesday he welcomes the convening of the country's new state council in Tripoli, calling it an important step. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
For reaction to the latest developments in Libya, senior Middle East reporter Mohammed El-Shenawi spoke to Hani Khalaf, Egypt's former ambassador to Libya. He says the actions by the unity government are a positive development.
Of course, I call this a must. The regaining of the confidence of all groups and regions of Libya and all institutions on the soil of Libya by the government should be considered the first priority. And I am sure the UN will support the unity government in all its actions to realize such kind of homogeneity and support from different institutions.
But the government of National Accord has yet to secure a similar concession from another rival administration based in Tobruk, which has long claimed international legitimacy because it was appointed by the parliament elected in 2014. How significant is to secure a similar concession from Tobruk?
Well, it is so important to have all these kind of concessions, or let us call it recognition by different governments, both in Tripoli and in Tobruk, because there is another one in Tripoli with Khalifa al-Ghuil and Nouri Bouzahmine. But the Tobruk one is the most internationally known government, and one should use a little bit of wise approaches in approaching the Tobruk government. I should recommend that the Egyptians may be utilized as intermediate in influencing the government in Tobruk to cooperate and recognize completely the official character of the newly unity government in Tripoli. You know, Mr. Shenawy, there are so many assets that Egypt has in the eastern area of Libya, mainly in Tobruk. Members of the parliament, members of the so-called Karama army officers are linked in a way or another with some Egyptian families and tribal ties and marriages and maybe economic and trade interests, the same religious and educational cultural traditions are similar. So Egyptians could be of help in approaching this Tobruk government.
Final question. What are the major challenges facing the unity government in Libya?
Oh, yes. There are so many major challenges facing this unity government. First of all, how to solve the problem of the proliferation of the arms and weaponry among various groups and militia with a view to establish or re-establish a new consolidated Libyan army on a rather unified, modern way. The second challenge should be to establish new bridges for communication and cooperation with more and various political and community ethnic groups of Libyan people, including the Tabu tribes, Tuaregs, and maybe Mosrata families as well, to consolidate the idea of the unity government itself. Lastly, one of the other challenges, I suppose, is how to make master plans in cooperation with neighboring countries and European Union and the UN organs to fight the expanding terrorist organizations such as Daesh or ISIS and the Qaeda from Sirte and parts of Derna and Benghazi. So these are the most important three challenges I can see presenting the priorities for the new government in Tripoli.
That was Hani Khalaf, Egypt's former ambassador to Libya. He spoke with VOA's Mohamed El Shenawy.
The deportation of migrants and refugees from Greece to Turkey is expected to resume on Friday. Several hundred more people are expected to be returned under the deal between the European Union and Turkey that took effect March 20th. After returning about 200 migrants on Monday from Lesbos and other Greek islands, the EU has paused its operations to make some changes. VOA correspondent Luis Ramirez is following the story from Izmir, Turkey. He spoke with Joe DiCapua about the EU announcement to change how migrants are treated.
A rather significant announcement. In fact, it helps explain why there's been a delay in the transport of deportees, which had been expected for Wednesday, now pushed back to Friday. We have both Greek and Turkish officials saying they are expecting to bring another approximate 200 migrants from Greece to Turkey.
The announcement from the EU is that they are developing a process now. They will begin making sure that there will be no automatic return. They say everyone will be given the right to apply for asylum. They will consider each case individually. That is to say, they will take vulnerabilities into consideration. This is after a pretty significant wave of protests, especially on Lesbos itself, by international human rights activists who condemned the deportation, saying they're not being done in a transparent manner and that the people who are being brought to Turkey, in some cases, their lives are in danger and the process is therefore irresponsible and dangerous. So this announcement was meant to counter those accusations, and on Wednesday, approximately 70 staffers with the EU's asylum agency arrived in Lesbos to begin setting up a process that essentially begins on Thursday. They'll start interviewing the migrants who are set to be deported to Turkey, hearing their cases individually in their language, which they weren't doing before, apparently, according to human rights activists and according to some of the migrants who were returning. They will have their cases heard. The determination is made as to whether they are eligible for asylum. If the determination is that they are not and that they will be deported to Turkey, they will now have 5 days to appeal that decision.
Now, this sounds like it could really slow down this whole process. The migrants and refugees on the Greek islands are now in basically detention camps, are they not?
The ones who are set to be deported are being held in a detention camp known as Moria. That currently houses, according to Médecins Sans Frontières, about 3,000 people. It was designed to hold 2,000. So overcrowding conditions are pretty severe. With 70 people processing these applications, which at least Wednesday morning, the number reached at about 1,000 people who had expressed a desire to apply for asylum. Well, you can do the math and figure out that it is going to take a long time to process them. The estimate, as explained to me by an EU official on Wednesday, is that they will be able to process a maximum of 50 cases per day. So when you have 3,000 on hold, that gives you a sense of how long it will take, a very long time.
Now, we're reaching you in Izmir, Turkey. We've had a lot of reports from Greece where many of the migrants and refugees had arrived, but not so much from Turkey itself. Can you tell me what's happening there?
In Turkey, it's a process that's very much, like in Greece, very much out of public view. And that's for a purpose, because government is conscious of the fact that people in Turkey are very nervous about reabsorbing potentially thousands of people. The Turkish government has initially welcomed the migrants at the start of this crisis, welcomed them as brothers. But then when it became clear that their stay was not going to be short and that Turkey might have to be responsible for them longer than it expected to be, that attitude began to change. It started to turn into a situation where Turkish people became nervous about whether their jobs would be taken by less expensive labor, if you would, and also the prospect of having so many people camped out in their cities, including here in Izmir. Some people saying they're glad that a lot of the city parks are now clear, that the migrants are no longer present. Others say, well, we're losing business in terms of hotel rooms, in terms of food, sales, things like that.
That's VOA correspondent Luis Ramirez from Izmir, Turkey. He spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua.
For 7 years, Boko Haram militants have waged a fundamentalist insurgency in three of Nigeria's northeastern states, killing 20,000 and displacing more than 1 million civilians. After a three-week joint Nigerian-Cameroon military campaign, officials have announced the capture of more than 300 rebel fighters and the release of more than 2,000 captive civilians. VOA's David Arnold talked to reporter Abubakar Haruna Galanchi in Kano about the military offensive.
The Nigerian Defense Headquarters, located in Abuja, stated that they have arrested almost 306 members of the Boko Haram with joint operation between the Nigerian army and the Cameroonian troops around Maiduguri and Adamawa. That is where the Boko Haram are located. It took them almost 2 to 3 weeks, which later they successfully arrested 306 members of Boko Haram, including one of the top leaders of the Boko Haram at the area.
Were they able to identify the name of this leader of Boko Haram?
Today, they didn't identify the actual name of the man. It can be recalled that in less than 1 week, the leader of the Boko Haram, that is Abu Bakr Shekau, appeared in a new video saying that he's calling to all his members to surrender to Nigerian troops as well as the Cameroonian and the other neighboring countries' troops. That's what he's saying. For now, they spent almost 7 years fighting Nigerian government. For now, it's okay for them, and they can surrender to Nigerian government to stop the normal bloodshed.
The report that we received yesterday also included the possibility that about 2,000 civilians who had been captured by Boko Haram have been released in this operation.
It's correct.
Is there any indication that this is a legitimate video that actually came from the leaders of Boko Haram?
Even from the Nigerian people, some of them are saying the video, they believe the video 100% is Boko Haram, while others are saying has already since more than 3 years ago is being killed by Nigerian troops. Consider the situation that Nigerian government is seeing. This conflict has already come to an end. But the problem is from time to time in a week, like two or three in a week, you can have that maybe in Adamawa or Yobe, Maiduguri, or some part of Cameroon territory, you have bomb explosion or gun attack in a mosque or in a church or something like that. The only the possibility for throwing Boko Haram or for ending this conflict is when the two governments, the Nigerian government and the Cameroonian government, when they join hands.
That was Abu Bakr Haruna Galanchi in Kano talking to VOA's David Arnold. Also, the French news agency reports that Nigeria has established a rehabilitation camp for former Boko Haram fighters. It quotes the Nigerian military as saying the camp will help reintegrate them into society. This would include vocational training. However, few other details about the camp have been released.
Albert Camus is world famous as the French-Algerian author of The Stranger and other philosophical novels. He was also the courageous editor of La Combat, the widely read newspaper of the French resistance to the Nazi occupation during World War II. Throughout his life, Camus struggled against what he saw as the brutality and absurdity of modern life, with its dehumanizing ideologies and wars. On March 28, 1946, in a historic speech he called The Human Crisis, Camus outlined his worldview at New York's Columbia University. He offered a roadmap for moral clarity, nonviolence, and brotherhood. Last week, to mark the 70th anniversary of the speech, actor Viggo Mortensen read The Human Crisis to a sold-out crowd at Columbia University. VOA's Adam Phillips reports on Camus' speech and its relevance today.
Camus' speech was born of the horrors the world had endured during World War II, which cost an estimated 60 million lives. And yet it was the post-war period that concerned Camus most. In his view, the world continued to be ruled by what he called the cult of efficiency and abstraction that underlay the German atrocities. Here's an excerpt from the address as read by Viggo Mortensen in a new translation by Yale University Camus scholar Alice Kaplan.
Yes. There is a human crisis because in today's world, we can contemplate the death or the torture of a human being with a feeling of indifference, friendly concern, scientific interest, or simple passivity. Yes, there is a human crisis, since putting a person to death can be regarded with something other than the horror and scandal it ought to provoke.
Camus gave actual examples of cruelties endured by people he had known during World War II. A Greek mother of three sons forced by an SS officer to choose which one would be allowed to live, and a landlady who, when addressed by a renter who had been tortured all night, told him,
I never interfere with my tenant's business. In Lyon, one of my comrades is dragged from his cell for a third round of questioning. Since his ears have been badly torn during a previous session, he is wearing a bandage around his head. The German officer who interrogates him is the same man who had conducted the previous sessions. And yet he asks him, with an air of affectionate concern, "How are your ears doing?"
This casual cruelty and detachment made no sense to Camus.
Passion, even deadly passion, would have been preferable. For passion runs its course, and another passion, another cry from the flesh or the heart, might replace it. But a man capable of tender concern for ears that he has only recently torn is not passionate. He is a mathematical calculation that cannot be restrained or reasoned with.
As the editor of La Combat, the underground journal of the French resistance, Camus had been in the belly of that beast. According to Suleiman Bachir Dian, professor of philosophy and Francophone studies at Columbia University, the human crisis was Camus' response to the absurdity of the human predicament. Part of Camus' solution, says Dion, was to place morality above politics or any ideology that says what history must be.
Politics meaning, in this case, in the context of the lecture, that you consider history to be true, events to be somehow necessary, and that gives justification and legitimizes violence.
Here's another excerpt from Camus' 1946 speech.
From the negative impetus that was the starting point of our revolt, we drew an ethos of liberty and sincerity. Yes, it was the act of communication that was needed to oppose the murderous world. That's what we understood going forward. And this communication must be maintained today if we are to protect ourselves from murder. As we know now, we must fight against injustice, against slavery and terror, because these three scourges are what makes silence reign among men, what builds barriers between them, what renders them invisible to one another and prevents them from finding the only value that might save them from this desperate world, the extended brotherhood of men struggling against fate.
Camus said that the venom did not disappear when the Nazis were defeated. Indeed, he asserted that each of us carries the venom in our own hearts, and we can sense this by the way we regard one another with vestiges of anger. Dion believes that this observation is as true today as it was in 1946. He adds that today it is mostly terrorists, not Nazis, who insist on the absolute truth of their beliefs and who commit unspeakable violence on a global scale. Like the Nazis, many religious extremists are humiliated and impoverished outliers whom society has ignored or shunned. For Camus, social justice and an end to violence go hand in hand.
We can't pretend to escape from history, for we are in history. We can only aspire to do battle in the arena of history to save from it that part of man which does not belong to it. We want only to rediscover the paths to a civilization where man, without turning his back on history, will no longer be enslaved by it, where the obligation each person incurs with regard to others will be balanced by time for reflection, pleasure, and the happiness every person owes themselves.
That was the actor Viggo Mortensen reading Albert Camus' 1946 speech, The Human Crisis, at Columbia University's Miller Theater in New York last week. The speech was translated from the French by Alice Kaplan of Yale University. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Sali, coming up at 18:30 UTC. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Aiden Utko, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss the role of development partners in promoting democracy and good governance in Africa. Join host Shaka Sali and his guests next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.